Hello, this is All the Best on FBI. My name is Eliza Salos. I'll be with you for the next hour. You have tuned in to our Instant Karma Supporter Drive program. It's that time of the year where we reach out to you, our listener, to support what we do here at FBI. We're independent, we're not for profit, and we support Sydney's creatives. Three phenomenally good reasons to support what we do and to keep us doing what we do. We do need your financial support. It costs a lot of money to run a radio station, around $3,000 a day. We don't get government dollars to pay the bills, and we don't want to stuff every hour full of ads from commercial sponsors, which is why we need you. Right now, be first cab off the rank. Give us a call, 833-222-945. There are a shitload of prizes, but really, supporting what we do, keeping us here, I reckon there's no better prize. Our amazing All the Best team will be taking your calls throughout today's show. They're waiting in the phone room right now, 833-222-945. Sign up as an FBI supporter this morning, and I promise you all the goodness of the universe in instant karma.
I think it was in 1995, FBI put out a t-shirt, and it was a little boy and a little girl. And I think one of them was pushing a trolley, like a little, you know, kid's trolley. And the boy had this speech bubble coming out of his mouth saying, "Ever dreamt of running your own radio station?" And the little girl's thought bubble was, "Fuck yeah." Yeah. I was that girl on the t-shirt. And it was always my dream job, was to contribute in a really meaningful way to the station and to its development.
Welcome to the story of FBI. On today's show, we're dedicating the entire program to this station and how it all began. That was Megan Loader, who, until a few months ago, was the station director here at FBI. She was just 19 when she first got involved. But before that, the idea of FBI had to be born. Let's go back to where it all began.
The people who started FBI are the people who felt strongly that the station should be there and felt strongly that the station should be there from the minute that Triple J went national.
That's Lee Hubber. In 1995, Lee had just started his own media company after a long history in community radio. A bit before that, when he was working at the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia, he met Jim Beetson. Jim was one of the founders of 4ZZZ in Brisbane, and here, at the beginning of our story, Jim finds himself back at 4ZZZ. Before heading north, he and Lee had cooked up an idea for a new radio station in Sydney. So strong was the idea that every week or two, Jim would call up Lee and hassle him to start that radio station. Here's Jim.
Lee said, well, he wouldn't do it by himself and that he needed somebody else in Sydney. And I said he could do it by himself. And he said, I'm not going to do it by myself. And we used to have this sort of friendly banter on the phone every week or two.
By the time we got our act together, which was when Jim returned from Brisbane, having worked hard to save 4ZZZ, he said, well, why don't we start that station in Sydney?
Much to my surprise and delight, Lee agreed that we would do it, but more than that, he would take on the lion's share of running the organisation, which he did.
We were all, or pretty much all, in our 30s at that stage. So we knew that a youth station in Sydney was not going to be a youth station, particularly for us. So there had to be a time, and an early time, where it actually became a youth station. So I was the inaugural president, and so the first thing I did was to stand down as president, and we looked for someone who would fit the role, and Cass was it, and Cass said yes, so that was great.
In 1995, Cass Wilkinson was working for a Keating backbencher in what was to be their last year in office. Cass told me that Jim came to her because her auntie Marion had started 4ZZZ with him in Brisbane, and her auntie Elaine was a co-founder of Sydney's Skid Row. Jim suggested she might want to continue the family tradition. She was just 23.
Sometimes you can just find yourself very lucky to be with the people you need to be with to make something happen. And I think part of the reason that that happened with FBI was it was such a compelling idea. I mean, you know, the old phrase, an idea whose time has come, couldn't be more true. You know, we're a city that is It's vibrant and exciting, and it's global. I mean, you know, we're talking today on a day where Sydney, for the 9th year in a row, has been nominated the world's best city to visit. And yet, at the time that we started this, it was a city people left if they wanted to be creative. It doesn't make any sense. You know, you think this is exactly the kind of town that's diverse and prosperous and interesting and open-minded, and it should be a creative incubator.
The essence of it was that Sydney didn't have a town centre, and FBI was to be the virtual town centre, a place where people gathered and met. Because physically, Sydney's not very suitable for a town centre. What is the town centre? Is it Martin Place? Is it Town Hall? Is it Parramatta? We don't know.
There was probably about a team of 8 or 10 of us who used to meet at the premises of one of the other founding people's work, so nothing to do with FBI, and to let us use their computers and photocopies and things, and we'd come up with mission statements and all this grand stuff, but not the nuts and bolts of what will we actually sound like. We'd say, we sound like Sydney. Well, what does that mean? And, you know, it's obviously for people of, you know, young-minded people would want to listen to it. Yeah, that's not hard to say. But what's hard to say is, how do you come up with the music that will work together to make it something that people want to listen to?
For as long as I've been at FBI, Tim Ritchie has been a fixture of this station. He was so interested in setting it up that he applied for leave without pay from the ABC to do just that, which was rejected. But they did allow him to sit on the board, which he has done to this day.
You're listening to the FBI Test Transmission. FBI launches in all its full-powered glory and with real live presenters on Friday the 29th of August. In the meantime, here are some bird noises.
Researching this story, we've been digging through the archives of FBI, trawling through old cassettes, mini discs, and CDs. And this is one of the things we found. If you tuned in to 94.5 on your FM dial in the months before FBI launched, this is what you'd hear. But we're not quite there. They didn't even have a license at this stage, and years of test broadcasts were ahead of them. Of course, you know how this story ends. You're listening to it. But we still need your support. This station runs on the passion of its volunteers and its listeners. And it's the time of year where we ask you to show that passion and support us in helping to support Sydney's music, art and culture. At this stage in our story, FBI only existed on paper. How shit would that be? If you're thankful we're here, call and become a supporter. 833-22-945. Again, 833-22-945. The producers of All the Best are waiting to take your call. Let's paint a picture of Sydney in the early 90s. Double J, Sydney's own radio station, had just gone national and become Triple J, leaving Sydney without a local youth broadcaster. Venues were closing down, bands were leaving town, and up-and-coming musos were finding it almost impossible to get a gig.
To an extent, Double J had been that resource for Sydney.
The existence of Double J and when it was there meant that they'd performed the role of sort of the concrete sort of, you know, champion. And when it went national, I think it left a hole.
There was a void for a local station. You know, obviously the common sense thing would be to have a creative, youth-based station for Sydney.
You might recognise that voice. It's Jack Shit, who's been broadcasting on FBI for more than a decade and continues to. We've already met Lee and Jim, two of the key catalysts in this story. Now, let's meet another, Simon Marnie. He's another voice you might recognise. He does weekends on 702. But before that, he was programming FBI's test broadcast.
Lee Hubbard called me. I was currently doing home duties with our son and had a lot of time on my hands. I'd left Triple J. I was reticent to be involved because FBI, I always thought, was a youth radio station, and I had seen at Triple J some people who had perhaps outstayed their welcome, who were closer to 60 than the demographic audience. So I said to Jim, yep, let's get involved. And we brought on board Chris Peakin, Margaret L. Sharmi, Terry Robert Edwards and myself, so that we had four people that would program it rather than one person laying down a dictate. And the brief was, let's just get the station a license and then anybody else can take over who's closer to the demographic and run it from there.
lot of energy went up. First up, raised money, and we got a lot of energy back from people who really wanted it to happen. The money dissipated, but I don't really think the energy did. The last 3 or 4 years, we really struggled to keep going financially to the point where we could be licensed.
FBI hit a critical hurdle with the change of government and the decision by the then Howard government to shut down the process until after they'd done all of the country town radio licenses instead. So we hit this sort of fallow period where people who had proper jobs and grown-up lives went back to their proper jobs and grown-up lives, and FBI found itself in the hands of the people who'd been sort of licking envelopes and helping out. One of the great things about community ventures of any kind is that people who, particularly if you're young, you get to do things that no one would ever trust you with if they had to pay you for it.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to All the Best. My name is Eliza Salos, and I'm thrilled to be bringing you the story of FBI. It's part of our Instant Karma supporter drive, and all of our guests today are the reason we're here on air. That's got to be worth some good karma. Call us now to get some karma of your own. These guests have given years of their lives to this station. All we're asking from you is $7 a month, $4 if you're a concession, 833-222-945. If you'd like to sign up as a supporter, you'll be in the running to win a ton of prizes. But really, if you consider yourself a fan of Sydney music, art and culture, the prize is keeping the station here. FBI is independent and proud of it. No one owns us except our supporters, which is you. So we're free to make the radio that makes us proud. You can help us keep doing that. 833-222-945. Really, if you like what we're doing, please, please support us. 833-222-945. Now, back to our story. We're at a pretty exciting moment.
I remember the very first test broadcast, we got access to a video shop on Crown Street that was vacant. The video shop was filthy. We had to spend a couple of days cleaning it out just so that we could broadcast. We put in all the sound equipment. We built the radio studio inside.
I remember that first broadcast really vividly because it was when Crown Street and Surry Hills was still pretty down and dirty, and there was the Clock Hotel used to be a bikey kind of hangout. So during broadcasts, we'd kind of have to time when you put the mic on for when like massive gangs of bikies were arriving and leaving at the pub next door, which is now, you know, a very swanky pub.
And I'm not sure whether the Broadcasting Tribunal know this, but I'm not sure we had permission to broadcast for that weekend. We certainly didn't have an antenna site. And so we put the transmitter antenna on the roof of the video shop, which meant that for 500 metres around there, anybody living in Surry Hills didn't get Channel 9, 10 or SBS, and they didn't get any FM station. The only thing they got on television and radio was our test transmission, which was pretty shambolic.
And we variously broadcast out of cafes and pubs and old offices. We had an office above the Guillotine restaurant next to Hoyt's in the city. We broadcast out of a truck at Bondi Beach, which was something of a disaster because it came with a giant bill for outside broadcasting that no one had really understood when they booked the truck.
My favourite would have had to have been, I have no idea how this was organised and can't imagine it happening again, but it was a caravan on Bondi Beach, and it was sweltering hot, but it was awesome because you could put on a really long track and then just go jump in the ocean and come back and back announce. And people stayed in the caravan overnight and just kind of looked after each other. And yeah, I just can't imagine that ever happening now.
So I would go around trying to find someone to let us put crap on their roof, and Megan would go around finding people who had records we could play and people who had interesting ideas for doing programs, and we would gather up all of this borrowed equipment. Quite often we would borrow in a very unofficial way gear from other radio stations, which was sort of done through networks of friends.
What was really great about it, especially the shopfront ones, the ones that were in touch with the public, is you could hear the traffic and you could hear people going by, and it felt very live, and people would come in and drop in. That really captured the energy of what FBI was looking for.
The idea of Jack Shit was that talkback program, essentially, a very irreverent form of talkback. I didn't like the way there was only right-wing talkback. I hoped to have this very ridiculous kind of engagement with listeners. It was quite frightening. When you're only broadcasting to a couple of suburbs, you wouldn't think you'd get any calls, and you'd be right. So when we started broadcasting that show underneath the Footbridge Theatre on Parramatta Road in Sydney University during a couple of months that we were broadcasting there, the first thing we had to do was fake calls. So I would have like six or seven stoned mates come in and, you know, go out into the lobby, hop on the blower and put these ridiculous voices on. And it was pretty agonizing listening. But for some reason, once we got the ball rolling with those fake calls, sure enough, it lit up. And it would just be this thing where people would come in on Saturday afternoons and absolutely go nuts on the phone in the studio. They'd be scratching my vinyl without me. Well, you know, I mean, it was absolute bedlam.
Coffee is starting to kick in along with the loud, raucous music on Roundabout.
Some bomb lyricists, man, doing big things at the moment. Their stuff's getting thrashed all over the place.
Today we're looking on Paul's Play Lunch electronica.
You're listening to FBI 94.5.
We're talking some big and fat breaks. Great record.
And still melding it with a really heavy, brooding dance floor pressure.
On the album show with Georgine Paris.
I do remember in the early years that there was this real sense that FBI was about to happen. There was only one other group of radio aspirants hanging around, putting together a temporary station every few months. And we'd been kind of told that it was going to happen. It was going to happen in a couple of months. And people started working full time on the station and getting really excited. There was a, you know, everyone was listening to it. Everyone you knew talked about it. And we really had a feeling that we're going to have a radio station in, you know, 6 months' time. And that kind of kept on drawing out and out. And as FBI became really popular and more people knew about it, other people thought, well, maybe I could start my own radio station, the more we kind of got word out about it. And so heaps of other aspirant stations came along and started broadcasting each weekend, and it got harder and harder for us to kind of book in time to run the station for the weekend. And the energy it took to put the radio station together for the weekend or the week or the 10 days in which we're broadcasting became kind of greater and greater. And we each time we did a broadcast, we had to kind of beg, borrow and steal equipment and a venue to broadcast from. So I have really fond memories of the broadcast spaces that we came from.
We broadcast out of 17 different locations over the 8 years of test broadcasting. We wound up in a little office with no toilet next to the Footbridge Theatre, which was our last semi-permanent home before we finally came to Redfern.
Where we still are today. You're listening to All The Best, our supporter drive show, where we're telling the story of FBI. My name is Eliza Salos, and so far on today's program, we've been through 17 venues and 8 years of test broadcasts, and we still don't have a radio license. Despite a dedicated team of volunteers, the station is penniless. One of the main reasons it was able to keep going was the generous support of its community. Listeners, volunteers, everyone that pitched in to help FBI in those early days. A lot has changed since then, but some stuff stays the same. We're still almost entirely run by volunteers, including everyone who works on this program, and we rely on you to keep us here. We're just a new program. We turned 6 months old a couple of weeks ago. And if you like what we do, call us and support FBI 833-22945. Now let's get back into this story, but while we're going there, pick up your phone, call 833-22945 and support this station.
I do remember the Broadcasting Tribunal hearings were very formal. Jim Beetz and Lee Hubber had an idea of what the process would be, but you were sworn in. So I had to go into like a courtroom. David Flint, who by night was the head of the Australian Monarchists Association, was head of the Broadcasting Authority, and it was like being in a courtroom. You were sworn in on a Bible. You were cross-examined by barristers for both sides. And I was surprised that somebody like David Flint was so enthusiastic about having a youth community station. So much so that there were a couple of other aspirants that were pretty commercial. Rather, they were calling themselves youth stations, but they were pretty commercial. And David Flint convened this great conversation about just because you have promos or community service announcements, does that mean you're commercial? And also, is a professional sounding station a commercial station? So it was quite a grueling process.
And in the mix there was Wild FM, who were playing a much more commercially oriented dance sound, and impressing a lot of people and getting a lot of media coverage because of the large audience that they generated, particularly for their off-air parties and events. So our political message was not only we had to position ourselves as supporting rather than cannibalising Triple J, and we had to promote the idea that we were able to nurture and encourage new art forms, including dance music, without sort of creating an argument for allowing a Wild FM, which really wasn't locally focused, it was principally playing overseas produced music, and explain all of this to an audience of grey-haired 50-year-old men who had control over the spectrum. Interestingly, when we finally got to the public hearing stage, the board members of the then ABA, Australian Broadcasting Authority, were quite lucid in the way that they understood that. And in fact, the chairman of the board said during the hearings, he said to give a licence right now to a station playing dance music would be equivalent to have given a radio licence in the 30s to a station playing ballroom dance. And he said, we're not going to allocate a licence based on a specific style at a moment in time. And the reason that they supported FBI was because they understood that because our mission was to play emerging music and to change to reflect whatever that was and allow the community and the industry and artists themselves to define and create and change music while we simply reflected what was going on instead of trying to freeze time and define culture. The ABA actually understood that what we were doing created a more history-proof public benefit for them in terms of making a decision. But it was quite an interesting process, you know, and I think from my perspective, a good argument for putting more public resources into the hands of people who are self-organising around putting them to some good public use. I had just had my daughter Holly the week that we got a letter in the mail saying, here's your licence to broadcast Sydney Music Arts and Culture on a full 150 kilowatt powered transmitter, full commercial power across Sydney. Well done. And I remember just being elated for about a second and a half and then immediately thinking about the $400 that we had in the bank at that point. And how on earth we were going to build a radio station with $400.
But they did. Thanks to our supporters, FBI got its licence. Help us continue to use that licence to bring you Sydney's own radio station 24/7. 833-22-945 is the number to call. Again, 833-22-945. Pick up the phone. And that's exactly what Cass did next.
Paul Mason suggested to me that I call someone called Brandon Saul, who I'd never met, and I rang Brandon one afternoon and said, you don't know me and I don't know you, but I've got a licence to make a radio station and I know you make rock festivals and it seems to me that you know how to make businesses out of music and I don't know how to make one out of our radio station, but I know what it is that we need to do and I'm sure it's going to work and I think you can help me work out how it's going to work.
Random phone call. I just remember, need help, have the license, can't quite get on air. No one actually told me that the ABA had asked for the license back at this point. And in all honesty, I remember thinking, I actually said to someone in my office, they're a bunch of Trotskyist troublemakers. I'm not sure I want to have anything to do with them. And look, there was a lot to be done. Like, I think the point that I entered the scene, and this is important to note, it's, you know, years and years and years after a lot of people contributed to getting the license, there was the challenge of building the station, coming up with the money. And I think at that point, sort of our net assets were a milk crate and a little bit of debt. But I think the second call I got was, look, the ABA want to see us. And, you know, I was a relatively young man at the time, and I remember turning up to the full board of the Australian Broadcasting Commission, Donald McDonald, and it was sort of a, please explain, you've had this license for quite a while, why aren't you on air? And I think it's actually a really good time to point out the fact that having such a substantial license brought with it the cost of having to negotiate with, at that point it was the Macquarie Bank, owned the only aerial antenna, for want of a better word, that we could broadcast from. And I think roughly it took around $1 million to put us on air. And just within context, Triple R started with $7,000 and an aerial at the university. So there was definitely sort of a hurdle we had to get across as a group.
When we did these interviews, the size of the license kept coming up. On one hand, it gave FBI the broadcast range of Nova, reaching from Wollongong to the Blue Mountains and almost up to Newcastle. FBI truly was Sydney's station. But with that size came massive financial requirements that were almost unprecedented for a community radio station. Those startup costs were mammoth, and the cost of broadcasting continues to be massive. It costs around $3,000 a day to run the station. Some of that we cover through advertising, but a lot of it comes through the support of our listeners. That's you. Call us and show your support. 833-22-945. 833-22-945. We have our team out in the phone room ready to take your call, ready to welcome you into being an FBI supporter. You're listening to All the Best, where we are telling the story of FBI. If you've tuned into our story, we're at the point where FBI's only just gotten its license. But then,
the first big challenge we had after we got the license was that Wild FM, who had been the quasi-commercial aspirant station, who, and I kid you not, had a machine called the DJ2000 in their fully equipped studios over next to Central Station, which I went down there and toured at one time. And between 6 p.m. at night and 6 in the morning, this machine played their playlist for them with ads interspersed, and there were no human beings in the building. It was a very non-community based approach to making radio that they had over there. And so the first problem we had was that the enterprising people at Wild FM were sufficiently enterprising enough to realise that if they didn't have a licence but we did have one, then what they could do, since we were a community organisation and we are owned by our members, was they could become our members and then take over the station and then change it to play the music that Wild had been playing and maintain their commercial base with their albums and their dance parties and all the rest of it. So we had, in the space of a week and a half, 400 applications for membership of FBI, which was, at the time, we had about 2,000 members that we'd accumulated over 8 years. So to get 400 in the space of a week and a half started to smell a bit odd. And George Cronus, who'd come over from Dex, and I spent a day and a half just calling people and asking them about their application and thanking them very much for their interest and inquiring about what had motivated them to get interested in local music, and almost entirely none of them had ever heard of FBI or what we were doing. So we went to see Gilbert and Tobin solicitors, who were kind enough to do some work for us for free. And long story short, in the end, the Wild FM members were excluded, but this took 6 months' worth of legal to-ing and fro-ing between Wild FM's lawyers and our lawyers, and Wild campaigning against us in the newspapers for trying to exclude them from FBI, and essentially Wild characterising us as a useless collection of incompetent thrash music idiots. Advent of the license that was given to Nova basically removed any argument that Wild had been fulfilling any niche in the community that was unmet in terms of listener preferences. But the more important thing was the time that we lost. So we lost 6 months of the year that we'd been given to start operations. So then we had to go back to the ABA and explain about the court case and explain about the delays and explain about how it was that 6 months later we still only had $400. But a plan.
I mean, a lot of people at Campaign put a lot of effort in over a long period of time, and to be honest, it was very debilitating that that process went on for such a long time. And I guess we were very lucky in as much as one of the commercial radio stations in Sydney was moving out of town, and they were getting rid of their studios, and more or less said to FBI, seeing you're buying a lot of our stuff secondhand, you can more or less help yourself to the building.
If you look around the studio right now, you can see that the soundproof windows and doors were taken from 2UE.
Yeah, these windows that we're sitting in here, I mean, this is mixed with the sweat of Alan Jones' brow in some way, shape or form.
When Alan Jones left 2UE and went to 2GB, GB created a beautiful new studio for Alan Jones, and they sold off their crappy old studios and we bought all the stuff. So these are the doors and windows that Alan Jones rejected.
It took a good year to actually build the station and raise the money, and, you know, I mean, there's the actual mechanics of having, you know, a microphone and a desk and people and staff and membership system and, you know, very crude website, and it took a lot of doing from, you know, a lot of people. And, you know, at some point I'd love to see a register of all the people that actually made it happen, because there were so many that were there before I arrived.
There was a lot of milestones. Winning the license was the huge one for us. When we started off, we considered ourselves not to be a radio station, but a campaign for a radio station. So the moment we were awarded the license, that was huge for all of us. And that is about when my direct involvement with FBI finished, because as far as I was concerned, the campaign was over. And, you know, as other people will attest, that's when the really hard work began. Seeing it on air, being a listener, that's fantastic. The first moment on air wasn't the big moment for me, but I know it was for the station.
When I was trying to put the vision of the station together post-test broadcast, because it had been about 18 months since we'd last broadcast before we went to air, I had to think about all the other stations that had done so well, the other aspirants, and stations like Dex and some of the other dance stations whose name I can't remember or won't remember. Had done really well and had grown a huge audience. And Sydney, that we'd started broadcasting to in 95, was a completely different city by the time we got the license, and music had really changed and audiences had changed. People who were going to bands when we started were not even going out anymore. So we really had a look at and a think about the music scene and creating a station that kind of captured all of, or as many of those audiences as we could. So not just indie music and rock music, but we were, you know, quite deliberately put dance music at 6 o'clock, which is your key listening time, to say to people, we're not just here to be the old FBI, we are the FBI that is reflecting what's happening now, and we hope to evolve.
Those trial broadcasts was much more indie rock is what FBI sounded like then. 7 years ago, it sounded much more like electro, if you're looking at, you know, broad genres. So there's more a sort of dance hip-hop when we first started, and much less of that dirty guitar thing. And so all the dirty guitar people hated it. And there was at an AGM, one of the members stood up and said, you know, where's the hard rock show? And there was shouts of protest. And so it was quite animated. And in fact, that's one of the interesting things. Over time, the members and volunteers have become less and less fighting about what it should be, because it has become it. And while it's still evolving, and hopefully will always evolve, it's evolving with the people, and the people are growing up, moving on, new ones are coming in, and it seems that it is perfectly placed to be that thing that satisfies a big chunk of Sydney.
I think for me, the thing that sticks in my head is the actual day we turned the switch on. And if anyone's been to the studios, they're pretty simple. And it was the physical coming together of a couple of hundred people here in the studio the day that the actual button went on. And it was a truly, you know, to be a community is to, I probably want to stress this, is a community is a group of like-minded people with a shared passion and interest. And that's what came together that day. And there were all sorts of people, old, young, you know, all from all the tribes of music here on that day. I think there was a couple of hundred people here in the station. Couldn't do it now with the furniture and everything else in here, but It was just a magical moment. I remember having, you know, I'd started without a child, had a very newborn child on my back. And I just remember her really, she just immediately became a member at the age of sort of 3 days. And I don't know, I sort of liked the idea of my daughter growing up to enjoy the station when she hits her teens or whenever it is. And that there'll be a sort of a historical legacy for there for the youngins to grow into.
Brandon's daughter became a supporter at the age of only 3 days old and is in her seventh year of supporting the station. Do you have a kid? A kitten? A pup? Invest in their future. Sign them up as an FBI supporter. 833-22-945. Of course, you can become one too. I want you to put down your cuppa and pick up the phone, especially if you've not supported this station before. Seriously, the feeling you will get from knowing you've invested in something this important to Sydney, it's unrivaled. 833-22-945. Give us a call. Now, back to day one of FBI. We caught up with Jess Keeley over the phone. She now lives in London. But back on August 29, 2003, she was nervously watching the clock count down to midday.
The sort of days and even hours before were a little bit surreal. I think it was quite strange. Everyone was so excited because there'd been such a lead-up and so much work put in to this big first broadcast. So when it was actually happening, it kind of felt a bit surreal. The hours beforehand, I went through the script so many times. I had so many pep talks. I had a lot of coffee. It was tense times. Everyone was there from about 9 o'clock in the morning, right in those studios in Alexandria, getting really excited for the first song and the first broadcast. Beforehand, there was drinks, there was people milling around, and gradually all of these media started to turn up. Media, celeb-type people, Sydney personalities, and also FBI volunteers. There was such a huge crowd.
In a couple of rooms that would have held comfortably 50 people, there was probably about 300 or so there, and you could barely hear the radio, the little speaker in the corner kind of thing. It was very enthusiastic, very sweaty and hot. It was August, it was our birthday month, and there was boundless joy, no thought to what particularly was going on. Like, it was just people who were so exuberant because it had been, for some people, a really long fight, many, many years before that point. And just watching people be liberated to enjoy the moment and that it was finally there, it was very good.
I got up and said something. I have no idea what. I actually can't remember. I was so tense. It was just before we launched. So it must have been, I reckon I did a speech at 11:45, ready for the midday broadcast. And I can't remember saying much else apart from, if you'll excuse me, I just have to get into the studio. So I got into the studio and sat there, and it was like being in a fishbowl. It was completely silent in the studio, but then outside it was madness. And it was so funny because it was just watching all of these people completely soundless. So people were milling around and cheersing champagne and hugging each other and waving at me through the window. And I had someone with a stopwatch telling me when it was going to hit midday. And as soon as it hit midday, we cracked into it. I broadcast something. I can't even really remember what I said. God, what a crazy moment. Something like, welcome to FBI.
Most people were outside paying practically no attention, just caught up in the moment while Jess had to concentrate. And she and I spent quite a lot of time working together on her sound and the sound of FBI and what it should be.
So the very first song that we kick off with at midday is Turn Up Your Radio, featuring many amazing Sydney musicians as guests on this track. So the track kicks in. I've now got sort of 3 minutes of sitting there and trying to breathe so we can get through the song and then continue with the broadcast, because the first broadcast isn't just the first song. It is 2 hours of fantastic Sydney music, fantastic Sydney guests, and really making a statement for FBI. So at the end of the first song, we had our very first guest on the official broadcast for FBI, and it was Sarah Blasco. I remember us just both being quite nervous and quite cute about it. It was a really lovely moment. Sarah was an inner west girl, was living really close to FBI. In fact, I think was maybe even living, share-flatting with some FBI volunteers. So all very nice and very friendly at that point, a very close-knit artistic community that you could already feel starting in the FBI walls. It was actually the beginning of a very good friendship for Sarah Blasco and I. We're still friends to this day. So FBI bringing us together and bringing together some amazing tunes for the rest of the afternoon.
I always imagined it would become what it's become. I knew it could be as compelling and listenable and evolving, ever evolving and interesting as it is now. Yeah, I've always had great faith in FBI.
You know, FBI gave me a kind of core in terms of taking what you garner from life in isolation and sharing it with not only like minds, but people that have completely different perspectives. And everyone grows from that. And I've learned a lot, and I just feel like it's a sustainable course. And, you know, prior to that, I have no idea what would have happened. I doubt I could still really be here in one form or another.
You know, the people might change, but I don't think the essence of what FBI is will change, because FBI is the people who are there. And if for some reason, I don't know what happens, but all the best people come to FBI.
About 3 years ago, there was a station meeting and I saw Megan Loder sort of said, oh, there's this new young volunteer, and there's this girl who is a young teen. And I thought, I hope her parents think it's okay that she's come to this part of Sydney and, you know, it's a bit rough and hanging out with people who are a bit older and, you know, boys alike. But anyway, I stopped worrying about that because it's not my responsibility. Time passes pretty quickly for me. At last year's Smack Awards, I went to go in and Ella was at the door as the door bitch person. And I thought, well, this is awful. We've got an underage person standing at the door of a licensed venue on our award night. This is going to go badly in the press. And then, of course, I realised it's 3 years later and she's no longer 15. She's 18. She's allowed to be there. And she's grown up as FBI has been growing up. And then I thought about it and thought, well, she's 18 now. FBI at that stage was 6. When FBI was born, she was 12 and would have never have heard anything. And constantly that idea that people hear as much as, you know, me or you have of FBI is can catch you out, and there'll be little Ellas hopefully all the time.
Bits and pieces of my childhood memories involve being around music and creative projects, which were all about providing places where people can be heard. And it sounds like an obvious thing to say, but I think the act of making your voice heard as a community of people just has these profound society-wide positive impacts, that it's a profoundly democratic thing to do, that it's a tremendous gesture of confidence in ourselves culturally. And one of the things that I love being able to see through FBI is that when we're all engaged in it, when we do it well, when we understand that ordinary Australian people are capable of producing extraordinary ideas and experiences, that just tells you that all your boundaries can be exceeded. It tells you that we can do anything we want here, and I think that's a profoundly socially optimistic thing to be a part of. We could do those things we said we'd
do. Now, what you've heard today is one attempt to tell the story of FBI, but of course it's a story that has so many more characters. It's important to note that each person we spoke with provided us with another long list of people who were essential in creating this station. Some people we'd like to particularly mention are Paul Mason, Millie Milgate, Christina Alvarez, Ken West, Kim Thomas, Pete Lusty, Bruno Bravich, Gilbert and Tobin Solicitors, George Cronus, Dan Zilber, Evan Caldor, and many more. Without these people, this station not only wouldn't be what it is today, it probably wouldn't even be. But of course, there's one very important part of this picture, and that is you. FBI is a community station, and you're its community. If you value this station and what it does for Sydney music, art and culture, I can't encourage you enough to sign up and support the station. You can do that right now by calling 833-22-945. Now, we've gone the whole show and I've been remiss in not telling you the prizes that are up for grabs this supporter drive. I think it's that I'm so blown away by FBI, by what FBI is, that anything else just seems an add-on. But pretty great add-on. You can win 2 nights at the Intercontinental Rialto Melbourne with flights and 2 nights at the Intercontinental Sydney, thanks to Hotel School. There's also 2 home audio systems thanks to Altec Lansing. There's a $2,000 voucher for Red Balloon experiences. 10 Double Zoo Friend annual memberships. There is so much, you know. I actually cannot go through it. I'm running out of time. But there are a shitload of prizes. But really, it all comes back to FBI and supporting what we do here. FBI was born and continues to be run on little more than a shitload of passion. And if you're passionate about the station, then call that number. Again, it's 833-22-945. Help us continue to do what we do. While you're doing that, I'd like to thank everyone who has helped out on today's show, the many people we interviewed, especially those who didn't make it into our final piece. As big a thank you to everyone that helped us put together the show, immense thanks to Sheila Stanton, our technical producer, and Jesse Cox, my co-producer for today's program. As you're ringing that number, 833-22-945, I'll just remind you that all of us that work on this show do it for nothing but the love. We're all volunteers. If you love what we do here at FBI, if you believe what we do is worthwhile and deserves support, then you're the best person to give that support. The last hour of our program has been showcasing you the people who have helped make this station happen. Become one of them. Pick up the phone and support FBI. 833-22-945. The soundtrack to you scoring that instant karma. Let's hear that first song that was played on FBI when we went full-time more than 7 years ago. It's the FBI All-Stars featuring Sarah Blasco, David McCormack, members of Front End Loader, Spod, and more. Here they are covering Masters Apprentices. Turn up your radio.
Here we go. Let's do this. Turn up now. That's true.
Oh, yeah!
Yeah!
I love this song now.